find it difficult to get the films now. It's all video, video, video.
Hello and welcome to The Letterboxd Show, a podcast about movies from Letterboxd, the social network for film lovers. Each episode, hosts Gemma and Slim, that's me, will be joined by Letterboxd friends for a discussion about their top four on Letterboxd, the four movies you choose as your favorite films on your Letterboxd profile. It's an opportunity to learn more about the community and add new movies to your watch list. We'll have links in the episode notes to the movies, lists, and profiles we talk about so you can follow along too.
And we'll be having a revolving cast of friends on the show. Filmmakers, podcasters, comedians, and normal people just like me and you, Slim, who love to sit down and watch a movie and log it on Letterboxd. This episode, to ease us in and introduce you to your new hosting duo, we are talking with each other. And in future episodes, you'll be hearing from us a lot. So we wanted to share how we connect with movies.
Gemma's top four includes A Room with a View from 1985. She writes in her review, "It's a cast that just keeps on getting more perfect as their careers roll on."
Slim's top four includes RoboCop from 1987. His review says, "Turn this movie into a white powder so I can snort it." I love that. It's perfect. Now, on with the show.
We're here. Gemma, hello.
Hello, Slim.
The new season of the Letterboxd Show. And the first thing that jumped into my mind was, since we're going to be talking about our top fours, were you feeling excitement or extreme dread knowing that you might have to watch Vanilla Sky ahead of this recording, since it's in my top four?
I am going to be deeply honest with you. I have an aversion to Tom Cruise at the best of times.
Can't believe this is the first and last episode of the new season.
That's all, folks. Thank you very much. And I think this is something that we've only just realized about each other, and maybe this was a terrible idea.
Literally the first conversation we have on the show about our diametrically opposed views on the actor known as Tom Cruise.
Let me just say, I am Team Nicole.
Okay. I mean, that also just paints a view of this podcast for the listeners, so maybe that's a positive.
Maybe in the end, we've got Team Nicole, we've got Team Tom. This is going to affect all guests we invite on for the future.
I was thinking, before we dig into kind of the actual content of the show, our top fours, maybe we talk about how we got to this point together. You know, I've often said that Letterboxd is my favorite social media site. And it inspired a podcast about movies I do called 70 Millimeter. Also, like many people, I just like to veg out and watch movies, whether that be in a movie theater or on my phone. God forbid, I'll watch a movie on my phone. I don't care.
The way Scorsese intended.
That's right. And it'll be whatever movie that pops across my feed. It could be a bad horror movie. It could be a Jean-Claude Van Damme movie on Tubi that I'll sit down and watch if it autoplays. But everyone has, you know, this ability to list their top four on Letterboxd. And it's kind of a cool, unique insight into that person and how they connect with movies. But what's your vibe with the top four itself on Letterboxd? I think everyone has kind of their own opinion on it.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about this from the perspective of, for example, the Letterboxd couple, the Mank couple. And, mm-hmm. you know, so if you're looking for love and you think that Letterboxd might be one of the ways in which you could do that, I imagine that top four information could come more in handy than good sense of humor, likes walks in the park, which feels very generic. Whereas, you know, saying these are my four favorite movies is a bit more information about a person and a bit more insight into their personality, potentially their generation. But also, I don't know, it's the most prominent part of your Letterboxd profile, right? So whether it's that you are just a pure, unadulterated cinema lover or a next level cinephile who likes to show off. That's your, when you're setting up your profile, it's kind of the first thing we ask members to do when they're joining Letterboxd for the first time. Some people use it to show off their most recent favorite fours.
Yeah.
And others list only one film in all four spots, which I kind of love. And I'm definitely on the hunt for one of those for an episode of this. And then there are the people who never change theirs, which I'm totally guilty of. I think I've...
You were saying how you might not have even changed yours since 2011.
I have changed one film in my top four, I think, since I joined Letterboxd 10 years ago. And
jeez.
But the Paddington pull was too strong to no longer have a Paddington movie in my top four.
Paddington is maybe the most magnetic individual ever put on screen. Once you experience the magic of Paddington, there's no going back.
There is no going back. And Paul King, bless his cotton socks or whatever fiber in his socks, he has done the movie world and families everywhere and darkest bear from darkest Peru fans everywhere the most magnificent favor by bringing Paddington to the screen.
God bless.
Yeah. And I think, I don't know, are we talking about Paddington yet?
We can get into Paddington. So we have, ahead of this episode, you know, I think we both went back and we looked at each other's top four. That's kind of the idea of this show. We want to talk with people in the community, filmmakers, podcast hosts, comedians about their top four, learn more about what made them choose that, what kind of memories they have watching those films, the kind of feelings that you get when thinking about your top four. I think we kind of saw that a little bit or heard it a little bit when you were talking about yours. I think it evokes a strong feeling when you, like, someone asks you, what's your top four? You kind of like throw your head back like, oh my God, yeah, can't wait to think about this. So we went and kind of watched each other's top fours and we talked a little bit about Tom Cruise.
Enough.
We've already passed the Vinyl Sky segment already out of my top four. But your top four, I hadn't seen three of the four before.
And I hadn't seen, I thought I had seen RoboCop out of your top four.
But
then I just realized that I was thinking about Judge Dredd and I'm just going to own that right now.
Very interesting combination of two films. Sylvester Stallone in Judge Dredd. My God. Didn't like Versace design the costumes in Judge Dredd?
Well, if that's true, that is a genius crossover right there.
It is.
Fashion and film.
It is. Probably the best part about that movie, but that's neither here nor there.
Also a nice New Zealand connection with our own Carl Urban taking on the role again more recently.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I forgot about the new one.
Yeah. So I guess should we tell our lovely listeners our top fours so they know what's coming in the conversation?
Let's hear it.
Okay, so Slim, your top four.
My top four, I need everyone just to get ready for this top four. This is as explanatory as you can get about me. My number one, which we don't have to get into anymore, Tom Cruise, Cameron Crowe's Vanilla Sky. There's a story behind that. Maybe for another day we can get into that.
Okay, I'm going to let you tell that story. Just maybe... in about 20 minutes.
Next on my list is RoboCop, the OG RoboCop film, Paul Verhoeven classic. Next on my list, Martin Scorsese's Casino.
I'm so curious about why that's Scorsese and I cannot wait to ask you.
A lot of fond memories. And my final one, which is a recent addition, this movie actually pushed out North by Northwest. Alfred Hitchcock got pushed out for Ninja 3, The Domination. Sam Furstenberg, I think, is the director of that movie. So maybe in a little bit we'll get into that. But what's your top four?
Well, I just wanted to say before we move on from North by Northwest that you've been on Letterboxd since 2015, according to your account.
Rumors.
according to data available to me at this time. And my favorite review of yours is from March 2015, and it is of Alfred Hitchcock's North by Northwest. And it says, Carrie's pants height inspires me to this day. And as a fan of the high-waisted pant, which will be discussed when we get to Strictly Ballroom, one of my top four, I just want to say thank you.
He's a vision in that movie. Everything he does in that movie, he's like a fashion icon, in my opinion.
It's extraordinary. I mean, you know, he's an ad man. He's a madman. He should be cutting a sharp figure in that cornfield. Yeah. Okay, my top four. And I want, does this say a lot about me? I guess it sort of does. Yes. Yeah. Okay, we've got A Room with a View, the great Merchant Ivory 1980s period classic from a novel by E.M. Forster. We have Strictly Ballroom, the very first feature film by Baz Luhrmann and his regular collaborators, Craig Pearce, his co-writer, Catherine Martin, the amazing CM production designer, and the first of what they call the Red Curtain Trilogy, which includes Romeo and Juliet and Moulin Rouge.
Didn't even know
but
that.
Strictly Ballroom, oh, yes, deeply Australian. And then we have the great, the mighty Paddington. Paddington 1, I might add. I didn't even think about whether it was going to be Paddington 2, which is more highly rated, but we'll get to that. And then finally, Jane Campion's awesome erotic thriller set in New York, starring Meg Ryan, America's sweetheart, in a super sexy role as Franny, and that is In the Cut.
Yeah, I didn't even know that movie existed until I heard you talking about it on a previous Letterboxd show episode in the past. Totally new to me.
Yeah, see?
Let's see. So where should we start first?
Let's start with Room with a View. And I'll explain the reason that it's number one in the pack is because it's got a beautiful backdrop. Mm. So when I started at Letterboxd, and that is, I was going to say the reason you're here is because you host the great 70mm pod, but also Letterboxd is your favorite social network and you're a podcasting genius and that's awesome. The reason I'm here is because I'm paid to be, it's my job. but more than that, I have known the lovely chaps who invented Letterboxd for quite a long time and was one of the beta users back when they first launched and sent a message out to their closest, nearest and dearest and said, please join our thing we made and let us know how to improve it. And so the tight-knit filmmaking community of New Zealand jumped on board to help them out. Mm. And when they started introducing the beautiful feature of having a backdrop on your profile for patron and pro-level members, is it pro-level? Patron? God, just I don't patron. Even know our own rules. Only
just patron.
Patron members get a beautiful backdrop of the movie that is first in their queue. And I just wanted on my profile the backdrop of one of the best, most romantic kisses in big screen cinema history, which is between Lucy Honeychurch and George Emerson Jr. in that field, up that hill, in A Room with a View. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in fairness, it is definitely in my top five most viewed movies of all time. I watched it again this week in preparation for this and probably hadn't actually watched it for a good 10 years. But before that, it was definitely a film that I would rent very, very often from the video store. Mm-hmm. Whenever it would land on TV, I'd just drop everything and watch it.
Did you read the book first?
No, I never read the book first. I did eventually read the book in the 90s at some point and adored how closely it hews. Mm-hmm. Look, I'm just going to explain what happens for anyone who hasn't seen Room with a View. Lucy Honeychurch. Now, this is the thing. This is a cast to absolutely die for. And
huge cast.
Lucy Honeychurch, who is played by the great Helena Bonham Carter. And she's young in this. She's just a wee, young, cute thing. She goes with her mother's cousin, Charlotte Bartlett, or poor, poor Charlotte, as she comes to be known in the film. Mm-hmm. Who is played by the great, now Dame, Maggie Smith, to Florence, where they stay for weeks in a pensione with a view of the Arno. Except Lucy and poor Charlotte do not have a view of the Arno.
This is not at all what we were led to expect.
I thought we were going to see the Arno.
The Signora distinctly wrote, south rooms with a view and close together, instead of which she's given us north rooms without a view and a long way apart.
Until George Emerson Sr., the wonderful Denham Elliot, and George Emerson Jr., the incredibly handsome, in 1985, Julian Sands, offer to swap rooms so Lucy and Charlotte can have a view. There's a trip to the countryside. George Emerson Jr. shouts beauty from a tree. There's one of the dreamiest, most sudden kisses ever in the history of cinema. Everyone is sworn to secrecy, especially cousin Charlotte's gossipy new friend, the trashy novelist Eleanor Lavish, who is played by Dame Judi Dench, who many movie viewers these days would know as the sort of the brilliant, kindly Judi Dench. But here she's just this, she's popping off as a gossipy novelist. She's brilliant. And then we're back in England, where Lucy Honeychurch is suddenly engaged to Daniel Day-Lewis. Da, da, da.
When he appeared on screen, I didn't even know he was in this movie.
I want to know what your reaction was.
I loved him in this. First of all, Helen Bonham Carter, I think this is the youngest I've ever seen her in a movie. I didn't realize how vast her catalog was, but man, Daniel Day-Lewis.
I know.
In another world in this role. I feel like more people should talk about this.
It is wild. He plays Cecil Vyse, who is quite buttoned up. And it's also got not one, but two manic pixie dream boys. Not just Julian Sands, but also the wonderful Freddie, Lucy Honeychurch's little brother.
Oh, yeah.
It's, you know, Dame Judi and Maggie absolutely going at it, and they're just chewing it up. And then two brilliant, very different portraits of religious men, the very uptight vicar in Florence, and then the wonderful Simon Callow, who gets his kit off, and in a scene that surely by now must have made it to your man ass list.
I did. I instantly, once the skinny dipping scene hit, I was like, oh my God, this is a whole lot of man ass that I need to add. It's not just man ass, it's man front as well.
Yes.
It's a long scene. I was thinking, this is a long scene. And then it went like the kind of like joke aspect of like, this is a great scene. And then I was like, holy crap, this is a long scene. And then it just like kept going. I was like, oh, this is a great scene. It went long enough to the point where it circled back. It was a lot of fun. There's the three of them having fun in that, you know, that little spot of water, and then them walking out and catching them. I thought it was hilarious. Oh, a lot of fun.
So brilliant. I feel like that Pride and Prejudice scene where Colin Firth rises out of the water in his white shirt that's, you know, sticking to his pecs gets a lot of airtime, and the skinny dipping in the lake scene in A Room with a View does not and ought to get more airtime.
Yeah, it's funny. I posted a photo on my Instagram of Daniel Day-Lewis, and I got a bunch of people were like, A Room with a View? You watching A Room with a View right now? And I had never seen this movie before, but it just like brought out so many of my friends that were like, oh my God, I can't wait to rewatch this. It's been so long since I've seen it myself. So really opened up something, this viewing.
I'm delighted to have brought it to you. And I would say that in the great Merchant Ivory productions, it's the most fun one. I mean, Maurice is a classic in terms of a portrayal of queer love in extremely repressed English times. Howard's End is just dreary. It's just dreary. I'm not a fan. It doesn't matter that it's the absolute bomb cast of Anthony Hopkins and Emma Thompson. I don't care. Mm-hmm. I watched it once. I'll never see it again. But A Room with a View, it's just got all the things in it. It's got this killer cast that only gets better. You know, the more we know about what they've gone on to do. But it's ridiculous and delightful and endlessly quotable and also, dare I say it, horny.
I'm glad I watched it, and it was a lot of fun.
I'm glad you watched it too.
Should we? Which one of mine should we talk about? My top four. Are we ready for this? This is a big shift here. We're going from A Room with a View to, you just got finished Casino. Maybe we should jump into Casino. It's fresh in your mind.
Yeah, and I feel like it exists in a similarly heightened world.
Very heightened, very heightened. More drugs and I think money flowing around.
Yeah.
Casino, Martin Scorsese, Robert De Niro. I was trying to think back. I actually used to work in a video store growing up. I used to work in a West Coast video chain, and it was the greatest job of all time. Working in a video store, there's literally nothing better except for the pay. The pay was terrible. But you get to pretty much watch movies all day. You get to talk movies all day. It's the dream.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I never worked in a video store. I did, however, spend a lot of time in video stores as a teenager with my friends. Mm-hmm. And when a group of friends would come in on a Friday, could you just tell that they were going to walk around and around for half an hour and then just pick the same movie again? as they did the last Friday.
What was worse is that we could probably predict when someone had a late fee. Late fees are like a totally foreign concept now, where people didn't bring a movie back and they had maybe like $70 in late fees on their account. Like, just the idea of not returning a movie and being charged almost $100 because it was late is just such a crazy idea to say out loud now.
Now it is, yeah.
But that was a fun experience. And Casino was one of the movies that I think I took home one night and I watched for the first time. And it might have been probably my earliest introduction to Scorsese at that time. So this was maybe before Goodfellas. So a lot of people like me, a lot of dudes like me hold Goodfellas up into really crazy high esteem. But Casino is the one that I really love.
When you love someone, you've got to trust them. There's no other way. You've got to give them the key to everything that's yours. Otherwise, what's the point? And for a while, I believed that's the kind of love I had.
I loved De Niro's character in this movie. I loved how Scorsese shot the casino itself. I love the kind of lighting that they pulled off in this movie and the camera movements he has in this film. You know, around De Niro and the cast of characters are just so, I think in my Letterboxd review, I said that he was just straight flexing on us for 2 hours plus. So I love that kind of camera work and the flexing that Marty did in this movie. Just the cast of characters with Joe Pesci as well. You know, there are so many people in this movie that I would probably just want to just watch 4 hours of, just to see what is going on in their crazy effed up life. Because everyone in this movie is just effed up, from drugs or love or money. There's just so many people that are so screwed up, and it's so entertaining to watch. Don Rickles is probably the less screwed up person in the entire movie, and he's amazing.
Don Rickles.
Yeah, a very quiet, sustained role in this movie. But this movie just always stands out to me as one of the most rewatchable movies that I love no matter what. It gives me the most enjoyment. And when I talk about like 5-star movies on Letterboxd, these are movies that I just have the best time watching. Maybe I'll give 5 stars to movies that are really not well made or not, you know, someone anywhere near someone's top 10 or top 100. But if I have a really fun time watching it, I'll give that 5-bagger immediately.
Well, I was going to say Ninja 3, The Domination, clearly not in your top 4 because it's in the Letterboxd top 250 of all time.
No, that movie is maybe in the bottom 250 of all time at Letterboxd. I'm not sure. But I had so much fun watching Ninja 3, Domination. Which is a crazy sentence for most people to hear out loud.
It is. I mean, let's pivot slightly to that and we'll come back to Casino, because I want to declare that it's the one film of your top 4 that I didn't watch because I couldn't find a legal version of it. And in my other life, I make movies. And so I'm a little bit of a nerd about that stuff.
Yeah, that is one of the things too. It's funny. I was having a conversation with, I think, Matthew, co-founder of Letterboxd. I was recommending a movie at some point in the past, and me forgetting that U.S. streaming capabilities is just very different outside of the U.S. So I think this was on Tubi, which is, you know, like a free movie streaming service in the States. I'm not sure if it's international availability, but there's just so many movies like that, like American Ninja is a franchise that's on Tubi. Most of Chuck Norris's movies are on Tubi, and Steven Seagal, so that paints a picture. So a friend of mine, Chuck Forsman, the cartoonist behind The End of the Effing World and I'm Not Okay With This, he has a podcast called Bat and Spider where they watch kind of like low-rent movies just like this, kind of like low-rent horror trash in a good way. It's trash you like watching. And he mentioned Ninja 3, and this had always been on my watch list. It was this woman holding a samurai sword, and it was the third movie in a ninja saga. And I was like, this poster is amazing. I have to see this. What is this? And it's essentially American Ninja combined with The Exorcist. And it's just one of the craziest combinations you can think of. She finds this samurai sword, this ninja sword, and it's like possessed. And when she holds it, the spirit of this dead ninja that died with the sword takes over her, body and she tries to kill the people that killed the ninja who died, and which are like all cops. So it's just this fitness instructor from the 80s going on a ninja killing rampage against just the worst men in society. It's just
that
crazy.
Actually,
it's
sounds so like totally my jam, and I will commit to finding yes. a copy to watch. And
I will
last...
mail you a Blu-ray of Ninja 3 if I have to.
I would love that. We do have two remaining video stores in this country that are pretty good. I just love the slug. He's the ultimate killer. She's the perfect weapon.
You can't go wrong, is what we're saying, people. You got to check out Ninja 3 if you can. And honestly, I think I'm probably only found the availability of this movie just because of Letterboxd. I use that feature to find out where movies are streaming like every day. I mean, I have the ability to kind of like put on a movie during the day while I'm answering emails. I'll have it in the background. So I see what's available. And
the way Scorsese like intended.
Just... If Scorsese knew how I watched most movies, he would flip out. But that was a roundabout way of saying Casino and Ninja 3 could not be more different, but I love them all the same. So those are two of my top four.
I did just want to say about Casino that I'm a big Scorsese fan, massive. How can you not be? But I'm just going to be honest and say Goodfellas and Casino. Haven't watched them. And it's mainly for a really stupid, dumb reason, which is I am sick of dudes talking about Goodfellas and Casino and how I have to watch them.
Yeah, it's like the Scarface poster in, you know, people's bedrooms. Like, yeah. Okay, we get it. You like Scarface.
Okay,
everyone
whatever.
Loves Scarface. But I totally get it. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe. But you are, yeah. Congratulations, Slim. You are the dude who made me watch Casino. But there was something in Casino that linked directly to Strictly Ballroom, Slim. And I don't know if you've figured out what it is.
No,
I have the screenshot receipts, which
Jeez.
Is not
There's
that.
No cocaine in Strictly Ballroom that I'm aware of. So that's out the window. What was it?
There is a sparkly gold dress that Sharon Stone wears. In a really beautiful scene where he's getting his award, he's getting his membership of the country club, and in Strictly Ballroom, there is a glittering sequined gold pantsuit that Scott Hastings wears when he does his own dance steps his way, which loses him his dance partner at the beginning of the film. And I just, those two outfits together, I feel like...
Serendipitous.
Yeah.
It was meant to be these two movies together in the same episode. Do you remember the first time you ever saw Strictly Ballroom?
I wish I did. It would have been in a cinema. And it would have been with a particular group of friends when I was actually a student studying film and television production. And we would have gone back to see it again that same weekend. So I don't remember the first time because it blurs into a week where I went back probably three times to see it in the cinema.
Wow.
Yeah.
What makes Strictly Ballroom fit into your top four?
Oh, well, look, Slim. First of all, have you eaten? Because if you haven't, there's some chops in the fridge. How's your bago pago? I think what I love about it, apart from the fact that it's the most quotable and best underdog sports film of all time involving ballroom dancing, it really was the first film by this group of impresarios who have gone on to make such an impact on cinema since. Written by Craig Pearce and Baz Luhrmann, who were schoolmates, not schoolmates, but like studied at NIDA together, which is the National Institute for Dramatic Arts in Australia. Production designed by Catherine Martin, who has designed all of Baz Luhrmann's films and also has babies with him. Edited by Jill Bilcock, who is the absolute goat editor of Australia's film history, so much so that she's one of the few editors to have a documentary made about her, which is really cool.
Wow.
They went on to make Romeo and Juliet. They went on to make Moulin Rouge, The Great Gatsby, and they're currently in post-production on Elvis. And so Strictly Ballroom grew out of a student play that they put together in 1984, and they staged it in a few places throughout the 80s on stage, and then they found a film producer who was willing to take it to the screen. And what I love about that as someone who's been sort of involved in all parts of the arts is the idea that, on the one hand, anyone listening to this who wants to make a movie, you often keep getting told, just pick up a camera and do it. You can do it. Just pick up a camera and do it. On the other hand, there are ideas that take such a long time to bring to the screen, but when they're brought to the screen, it's at exactly the right time. So if they tried to do Strictly Ballroom as a film in the 80s, which was a time when, especially in the Antipodes in New Zealand and Australia, we were producing some quite sort of hardcore films, you know, like some dark, toxic masculinity takes on, man alone type stuff. But the early 90s, this is a 1992 release, was sort of exactly when you had, gay pride taking off in Sydney, when the soundtrack for this film became a moment in nightclubs across Australia. The beautiful Lovers in the Air, which is the final song for the final big ballroom sequence, was played pretty much every queer nightclub across New Zealand and Australia as soon as this film came out. There's something about the timing that I love of it. And it's sort of strange to look at it now and think it was hard for those people to find the money that they needed, but they put together a $5 million budget and it got whittled down to 3.3. They eventually managed to make it on that pittance, and it's made $80 million worldwide. I just love that anyway.
Yeah, I had never seen this before. I don't even know if I heard the title before. This is another one of those movies that I'd never seen, but in the Discord that we have for 70mm, we call it the VHS Village. It's just a community where we talk about movies. I posted my review in there and a bunch of people were like, oh my God, you watch Strictly Ballroom? You know, I can't believe it. Are we having a watch party for Strictly Ballroom this week in Discord? It was like ignited that everyone had this like as one of their fave movies. And what struck me about this movie, it's hilarious. It felt like a Waiting for Guffman-esque, you subtle comedy about these quirky characters, just like you said, which I was not expecting. You know, I'm used to, I had just rewatched Romeo and Juliet, I think this past year. So that was the kind of Baz Luhrmann in my mind. So when the funny moments in this movie were coming out, I was like, oh, what's going on here? I was not expecting this, but it was a total delight. I think I gave this 5 stars on Letterboxd. I had an amazing time.
Amazing time. It's so good to hear because it is funny. It's so funny. And it's funny because it's true. You know, the best comedy sort of comes from truth. And so, one of my favorite quotes that I picked up this time around was when Scott Hastings' mother, Shirley Hastings, the great Pat Thompson, who tragically died a month before this film premiered at Cannes.
Oh, geez.
And so not only a huge loss for the family of Strictly Ballroom, but you know, this was a career-making role. And then... Mm-hmm. She's gone, but there's a moment where she cries into the arms of Les, who's, you know, another judge in the ballroom dancing scene. He's my only son. and it's hard to describe why that is such a emotional and extremely comical piece of dialogue. But, you know, the idea that she doesn't have another son who she can train up from the age of 6 to win the Pan Pacifics. And if Scott doesn't pull himself together, this is the end of her career. This is the end of her dance studio. Yeah, I just love that. He's my only son. It's so Australian.
Is there any way better to segue into RoboCop than from Strictly Ballroom into the ultimate action adventure from the 80s? RoboCop is in my top 4. I think this was probably, you know, on local television in Philadelphia at the time. You know, PHL 17 was a station that would play, you know, edited action movies. RoboCop, obviously 80s dystopian future where the large corporations of our day have taken over the police department, just about everything. So we're not too far away from that today, depending on who you ask. But Peter Weller is the titular RoboCop, and he kind of has to battle to find himself. And this is just one of those movies I think I saw when I was younger, way too young, way too violent, where when I saw it as a kid, I thought it was just this really fun action movie, violence. I saw a robot cop, you know, just like shooting bad guys, driving a car. I was like, oh my God, this is really cool. And then as an adult, you watch it again, and I'm starting to kind of like peel back layers of the kind of absurdity of the film, about how insane it is, about how this corporation owns these places, and we're kind of rooting for this police officer cyborg. And then you watch it a few more times, and I just feel like this is a movie that had no right to be a success whatsoever. This could have easily been maybe the end of Verhoeven's career at this point. You know, you're gambling on 1987 turning this guy into a cyborg and fighting crime. And it ends up being this really subversive classic that is so fun, at least for me, to rewatch and enjoy time after time. And he went on to do it a few more times. He did Total Recall. He had Starship Troopers. And he's got this amazing catalog after that.
And he's got a film at Cannes this year.
And that movie looks amazing too.
Benedetta, it looks incredible. He's still going.
He is. I also just watched Basic Instinct for the second time in a very long time this past year, which I thought was amazing.
I have not seen it since.
Still holds up, in my opinion.
Yeah, still holds up.
Also, his other movie, L. Have you seen L from 2016?
I have not seen L. Holy when it comes to Verhoeven, I am basically a showgirls girl. I don't know why.
Showgirls was the reason why I created the man-ass list in the first place on Letterboxd. Kyle MacLachlan is in Showgirls, and what I presume is a stunt double, and like a stunt ass, steps across the screen, and it is probably one of the most supple asses I have ever seen in a movie. I was like stunned. I was like, holy God, that is an ass. And I had to make a letterbox list right away. I was like, I need a list of the best man asses in movies. But it's Showgirls and everything else, in my opinion. Do you remember that ass? Do you remember the scene I'm talking about?
I do. Yes, we've talked about this before. I mean, who can not remember that ass? Who cannot remember that ass? Well, since we're talking about ass in Verhoeven films, can we talk about boobs in Verhoeven films?
Let's get into it.
I had a really interesting reaction to RoboCop, and this was my first viewing. As I said, I honestly thought that I was, you know, in the Judge Dredd universe, and it turns out how wrong I was. How wrong. Mm-hmm. And of course, I have seen many memes and GIFs involving the RoboCops themselves, but had never watched the film from front to end. And aside from all of the reasons you love it, all of which I agree with, I had a really interesting reaction to Officer Lewis and the portrayal of women in this movie, because I realized as I was watching that my sort of Hollywood expectations as a movie viewer, I was expecting certain things to happen that didn't. I was expecting, and don't get me wrong, Lewis and Murphy have great chemistry, which is part and parcel of buddy cops, you know, cop partners. Mm-hmm. You have to have good chemistry. It's your work husband and your work wife, right? But because the ways in which Hollywood has written these films for decades, I was expecting them to get together. I was expecting in a Verhoeven movie to see a lot of unnecessary breasts, like even in that beautiful memory of his wife coming towards him in the bedroom and saying, I've got to tell you something. When we finally get to see that memory play out in full, I was expecting her to just open her gown and there are the boobs. Something about Verhoeven, something about the 80s, something about cop movies. I was just fully expecting unnecessary, gratuitous, random boobage. Instead, we get that incredible scene near the beginning of the film where the cops are in a multi-gender locker room. So they're all in there. We see some man ass in the showers getting dressed, and we see Officer Lewis and other officers just getting their clothes off and suiting up, putting on their bulletproof vests. And it is not sexual, and it is super straightforward, and it is completely functional and part of their cop work. And it is also very much a Verhoeven universe, right? Yeah. He's like, in Verhoeven's world, all cops, regardless of gender, in the same changing room, putting on their bulletproof vests. And I loved it. I just deeply had a moment of deep appreciation for Verhoeven's very European vibe around the body and its functionality in this scenario.
It's funny you say that. I have like a giant making of hardcover for RoboCop, and it goes into detail. I think this is probably kind of like my first introduction to that Europe, like you said, the European sensibility. I think Verhoeven is Dutch and is very, you know, comfortable in nudity. And this is probably growing up, this is my first introduction to that. Like seeing kind of unisex locker rooms, you know, as a kid, you're like, whoa, what is going on here? This doesn't make any sense. And it happens again in Starship Troopers. And it's just normal. It's like the human body is normal and, you know, it's a part of life. And it's kind of like an American thing where we've kind of vilified the nipple or, you know, any nudity of the sort. And this is 1987, and he kind of kept that up in some of his other science fiction films.
Yeah,
and
it's
just one of those things.
It's just one of those things. It's just so great to see the breast non-sexualized.
Mm-hmm. Also, Nancy Allen in this movie is incredible. Her character is unbelievable. Unfortunately, it kind of, she doesn't get to be the amazing Lewis that she is in this movie. And I think it kind of goes off of a little bit of a cliff slowly until 3. But man, the potential was there for her to just to continue to be kind of the ultimate cop in this franchise. So I really do appreciate her in this, in what we did get in RoboCop 1.
Oh yeah, I love it. It's time to just talk for a few minutes about Paddington, I think.
Yes.
Because this is, one of my great loves when it comes to movies is when animation and real life meet and marry into a perfect union. It's a long time since I've seen Who Framed Roger Rabbit, but I remember loving it as a kid when I first saw it. Didn't bother with the new Tom and Jerry. Big fan of Mary Poppins. And I would put Paddington in the same camp, even though he's rendered as a realistic bear, he's still, you know, some kind of animation in there. And it's just so, you know, I would approach a movie like Paddington first and foremost with the wonder of the production, of the visual effects geniuses and the excellent cast who managed to pull off this thing happening where Paddington's not there. He's not there. But in the movie, he's there and he's perfect and we love him and he's amazing. Anyway, that just sounds super nerdy, but that's my, you know, the first way I come to it is through just deep appreciation for the craftspeople behind bringing something so delightful and so joyous to us.
How did you get here?
I stowed away in a lifeboat.
Cool.
And ate marmalade. Did you know bears like marmalade?
I didn't even know bears could talk.
Oh, well, I'm a very rare bear. There aren't many of us left.
What are you going to do now?
Well, I thought I would probably just sleep over there in that bin.
That's the spirit. Anyway.
Dad! Why don't we find you some help?
Oh, yes, please. If you're sure it's no trouble.
Of course it isn't. Is it, darling?
Not at all.
You mentioned it earlier with Paddington and the kind of like heart of this movie. I feel like Paddington really shocked a lot of people when this movie came out. You know, you're making a live-action-esque Paddington movie. You know, that could just be kind of like an all-ages family movie. But man, these movies have connected with so many adults, myself included, that, oh my God, it's just so fun to go back and watch these movies. They're just so pure.
I had a really fun time on Letterboxd, actually, as Paddington rolled out across the world. Because what happened was it came out in the UK as 2014, so late 2014 came out. I had heard the rumors that it was good. I started noticing our UK-based members just going off about Paddington. Mm. And to put it in context, Paddington is a character and stories created by Michael Bond, who was still alive in his 90s at the time that they were making the first film. And he's since passed on, but there's a beautiful photo of Michael Bond visiting Paul King on the set of of the first Paddington film. And if you had grown up with Paddington, the original animation at all, after the books, there was then a TV series made, which is stop motion animation, but of paper cutout characters of Paddington and the Brown family. And it's so simple. It's so pure and so delightful and has gorgeous theme music. And in making something that's incredibly slick and, you know, incredibly well CGI'd, Paul King and his team have kept the heart of not only the character and the books from Michael Bond, but the heart of that original TV series in there, you know, and including bringing in some of that paper cutout animation for certain parts of the story in both films. So it starts off being authentic, you know, it starts off from a place of authentic love for all of the Paddington properties that have come before. And that is, I think, what has made it so successful from the start. And then, as you said, it's become this thing that adults love. And I reckon there's a couple of tricks to that. And one is it's dark enough for adults. Like, shit gets pretty dark when Nicole Kidman's character starts roofying Paddington and laying him out for dissection so that she can display him in a glass case in her museum so that she can get back into the society that her father was so roundly ejected from because he refused to collect these bears who were wonderful and could talk in darkest Peru. I think that's the heart of the story, right? Like, that stuff is dark. She's got the taxi driver hanging up by his feet under a bridge so she can get information out of him. She's a good baddie. I will say
and
that.
And you said you were team Nicole Kidman earlier to start the show, which is one of the worst villains in the history of cinema. Makes me sick.
Yeah, because that's the thing. This is, like, it is Nicole Kidman. I just think she's perfect. I think she's perfect. I think she's perfect as a baddie. I think she's perfect as a goodie. And by the way, my Nicole Kidman love, it wasn't always there, but it's grown. It's grown.
What kicked off the Nicole resurgence for you?
I think the divorce. Yeah.
Her freedom.
Yeah, her freedom. And that photo, that iconic photo.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Oh,
of her just fists, arms in the air. Divorced from La Cruz. It's exciting.
Should we segue into Vanilla Sky as shortly as we possibly can? That's my final top four. We already made our feelings known on the star of this movie, but at the time I think this came out, I saw this in theaters. A lot of these movies I can kind of trace back to my days at West Coast Video. It was around the time where the store had just started converting to DVD. So they had like two different sections of VHS and DVD, and they eventually combined them. So I think my first week might have been when this movie had come out. So it was in early 2000, 2001. And I saw it in theaters, and I was a T. Cruz fan, Tom C. We don't have to say his full name. And I saw this in theaters probably after Jerry Maguire. And I just remember sitting in the theater thinking that it was such a gamble of a movie, a strange movie for the height of his kind of career at that time, to just make this kind of weird psychological drama where for half the movie, his face was just like mutilated. so like at the end of the movie, I just thought it was so risky and, to use the word, brave on Cameron Crowe's part to take this Spanish film and make an English version of it starring Tom Cruise. It kind of blew me away when I first saw it. And it's just always remained in my mind as one of the most enjoyable movies that I can watch, due in part because it's just such a strange departure in that time frame for that actor at that time.
And for the director, I guess, too.
I don't love Cameron Crowe now. I don't think he ever really captured what he had done before this. You know, Almost Famous, Say Anything, Jerry Maguire, Vanilla Sky, and then stuff after that. I think he did like Elizabeth Town with Orlando Bloom. So the stuff he did after that never really, at least in my mind or in the mainstream, really caught up. And I know he did a Pearl Jam documentary. But yeah, I love Jerry Maguire. I would love to sit down and just watch Jerry Maguire for no reason. Those are just the movies that I'll give high ratings to movies that just make me feel sad or happy and just know that it's just pulling strings on purpose to make those emotions come out. I'll rewatch those movies any day of the week. Jerry Maguire is one of those. Did you watch it?
I did watch Vanilla Sky. I now no longer need to watch it again.
When you logged it on Letterboxd, Proto and Danny, the co-host of 70 Millimeter, the movie podcast I do, we have a Discord DM, and I screenshotted your recently from Friends. I think it just had the watched. It had no rating. It had no like. And I just posted it to them in our DM, and I was like, it's over. But I appreciate you making the college try. I'm fully aware that I'm in the minority, I think, for people that love movies. I don't consider myself like a cinephile. I'm just like a film lover. I love to watch and sit them and watch them. I'm fully aware that a lot of people do not appreciate him in the way that I do. So it's no insult to me, but I'm just so glad that you made the college try.
I want to say a few things. I want to say from a plot perspective, I'm not the biggest fan of puzzle movies. Just not a big fan of puzzle movies. And when I realized this was one of them, I was like, oh, now it's even worse. I give many points to all of the players who are going hard in this puzzle world of Tom Cruise's character. Kurt Russell.
I'm real. I'm mortality as home entertainment. This cannot be the future. Can it?
Great hair. Interesting. Amazing performance. Jason Lee, I feel like his sort of doofiness was kind of the key to the whole thing. And I saw one commentary on this film that suggested that the whole thing was just a really average novel written by Jason Lee. And I thought, I do love kind of reading into the theories that come out about puzzle movies. And I know that the marketing and of course the brief romance between Penelope Cruz and Tom Cruise was what kind of put this on the screen. And I guess that's partly why I didn't watch it the first time around. But I hadn't realized that Cameron Diaz gave quite so much in this film. I really, really appreciated that. So that's what I have to say about Vanilla Sky. And also an observation about your top four. Is that Vanilla Sky and RoboCop kind of exist as unusual mirrors of each other, in that you have one man whose body has been taken and disfigured by a giant corporation to do their bidding, and you have another man who has chosen to take his disfigured body to a corporation for his own ends.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciated the mirrored double featureness of that experience this week.
I appreciate you making that connection and bringing that to the positive side of the table. I've never seen the kind of work that went into putting that together. There's one more movie that we haven't talked about yet. It's your final movie in your top four, In the Cut.
Yeah, speaking of New York.
Yeah.
Speaking of weird erotic dramas in New York.
This is, it's funny. There's another section of Letterboxd that we were going to dig into, rated higher than average. There's a section for your stats page where you can see for yourself or for others what movies you've rated higher than the average Letterboxd user.
And you can also see what movies you've rated lower than the Letterboxd average,
yes,
I think.
Yes.
This is a new feature we brought in only a couple of months ago because it's so much fun. And also, like, there's a sense that there's the average and, you look at the average and a lot of people make sort of pop quiz decisions on whether they're going to watch something based on, oh, well, if it's only a three, I think I'm not going to waste my time on things that are less than a five. Whereas mm-hmm. the way I use Letterboxd quite often is I hear about a film that I know I'd personally be interested in. I look at the average rating and think, well, that can't be right. So then I go to the people I follow whose opinions I have learned to appreciate over time, including yours about everything except Vanilla Sky. And then I look at what they're rating it, and that gives me my answer. But yes, you're right. So we've got this section called Rated Higher Than Average, where you can find out what you rate higher than the average. And In the Cut most definitely is one of mine. But this leads me to my favourite story about In the Cut that I love telling as it relates to Letterboxd, which is In the Cut's average rating generally on Letterboxd is higher than any other movie aggregation site, because really? Letterboxders have taste. Yeah.
What, I mean, there's probably people that are listening that are like me that had no idea what this movie is, but this is a Meg Ryan feature with Mark Ruffalo erotic thriller. I'd never heard of it before.
I know. It's a Meg Ryan, Mark Ruffalo erotic thriller. Jane Campion, obviously great New Zealand director, the only woman to win a Palme d'Or on her own so far, which is insane. She made the brilliant series Top of the Lake. She's worked with the wonderful Nicole Kidman several times. And a woman is murdered in Meg Ryan's neighborhood. And so the cops come interviewing the neighbors to see if they heard anything or saw anything. And this brings a detective played by an extremely young and handsome Mark Ruffalo into Franny's life. And then more things happen, more women are murdered and dismembered. And meanwhile, Franny is wondering whether Mark Ruffalo might have had something to do with those murders, but at the same time is becoming increasingly attracted to him, and he is offering himself to her in whatever way she would like to take him, in that beautiful steamy scene in the bar where he just says to her, "I can be whatever you want.
I can be whatever you want me to be. Now you want me to romance you, take you to a classy restaurant, no problem. You want me to be your best friend and fuck you, treat
you good." I was obsessed with Nora Ephron's Sleepless in Seattle. If I'd had Letterboxd in 1993, I probably would have logged that film once a week. I may have even once written some erotic fan fiction about it long before fan fiction was a thing. I loved that film. I loved the corniness of it. I loved the impossible Empire State building meetingness of it. I love the whole Meg Ryan, Tom Hanks thing through the 90s. But by 2003, I guess I'd had a decade of being a third wave feminist watching movies that just trash on women's bodies and use women's bodies as the means towards other people having a plot. And what, you know, we had Single White Female, we had, you know, just murder mysteries that were just dead women's bodies everywhere. And what I loved about In the Cut, let's be honest, apart from the extremely steamy sessions between Ruffalo and Ryan, is that there's this thing about being a woman watching movies that involve women's bodies being murdered and dismembered and cruel psychopathic killers on the loose, is that there's sort of no respite from that. And In the Cut, and Jane Campion generally does this amazing and sort of indescribable thing where she allows a sexual life and an interior life for a female character to exist in that world. That world is not going away from movies. It's you know, it's endlessly an interesting world to explore for directors. But to then bring in the reality that even while there are murders going on in your neighborhood, you might also still want to have sex, it was just like a miracle. It's hard to explain how it felt at the time. It felt miraculous. It felt like, another movie about this stuff. Oh, and also, it's okay to have sex.
Yeah, as I was watching it, I thought the miraculous aspect of it, that I felt like this felt like it happened in such a window where it couldn't have happened 10 years before and might not have been able to happen 10 years after.
And it didn't even really happen at the time, because at the time, the reviewers bombed it. It got a Metacritic F score. And basically nobody could accept Meg Ryan in a role like this.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Do you know anyone else with this in their top four?
Oh, good question. Personally, no. So if you want to know who else has a film in their top four, you go to the film's page on Letterboxd, you go to the little ratings histogram, and then it will say how many fans it has. And In the Cut has a very modest and frankly, you know, distressing 42 fans, which means 42 people on Letterboxd have this film in their top four.
You know how many people have Vanilla Sky in their top four? 524. But I think this conversation and the discussion of how we use our top fours and how what movies we place in there, that's what I'm excited about to have with other people, because, you know, this movie I never probably would have watched if I didn't hear about it from you and your reasoning behind it in your top four. So I'm grateful that we got to talk about it, because otherwise I never would have experienced a movie like this, let alone know it exists.
Yeah, and I definitely would not have watched Vanilla Sky if it wasn't for this podcast.
RoboCop,
concept.
I think, is RoboCop's the big win for us, I think, this week, that you got to watch RoboCop.
Yeah, RoboCop's the big win, and finally ticking Casino off the Scorsese list. I'm grateful for that. I feel like in terms of lush costumes on screen this week between Strictly Ballroom and Casino, my eyes have had a really good time. And I'm really looking forward to how this proceeds in the coming weeks and months in terms of other people's top fours, because I just know, we've built a kind of master list of people we want to hit up. And we are going to be swerving from anime to pre-code classics to 60s, detective noir. It's going to go all over the place. And I'm really excited, because one of the things I struggle with as the editor-in-chief of Letterboxd is that my viewing is generally focused on new releases, on things that are coming out, that are coming up, that I need to be across in order to know how to approach editorially. And so then when I dive into some of the collections that you see Letterboxd members completing, like our top 250 or Edgar Wright's, 100 of his favorite comedies or whatever, I just don't know where to start. I feel like I'm never going to be able to be a completist in terms of filmographies or collections like that, because there's too much else on my plate as part of the day job at Letterboxd. And so what's so exciting about this top four concept is it's just going to take us everywhere. And I couldn't be more delighted to be doing it with you.
Oh, man. And just think the excitement we'll have together after you watch Ninja 3 The Domination.
I can't wait. Thanks so much for listening to this first episode in the brand new season of The Letterboxd Show. You can follow me, Gemma, and Slim, and our HQ page on Letterboxd using the links in our episode notes. And also, why not follow 70mm Pod while you're there? No, Slim didn't pay me to say that. Thanks to our composing dynamos, Monica, for their theme music, Vampiros Danzotech. I don't know if you know this, Slim, but that particular track is an outtake from the film What We Do in the Shadows.
I didn't know that. It's amazing. If you're enjoying the show and have guest ideas or want to pitch us on your own top four, be sure to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts.
You can also hit us up on our Twitter and Instagram accounts, which are both at Letterboxd. That's it for this week. In the immortal, perfect words of Paddington, if we are kind and polite, the world will be right. And in the even deeper words of Ginger from Casino, you can't make me stop caring about people.
This is a Tape Deck Podcast.